the bell in the tower, Uncle Ray brought around. Don't worry about the army in the cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Now don't be a crybaby when there's wood in the shed. There's a bird in the chimney and a stone in my bed. When the road's washed out, we pass the bottle around and wait in the arms of the cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. There's a ribbon in the willow, there's a tire swing rope, and a briar patch of berries taking over the slope. The cattle sleep in the mailbox and we'll never go to town till we bury every dream in the cold, cold ground. In the cold, cold ground. In the cold, cold ground. In the cold, cold ground.
Welcome back to The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. You are listening to episode 8, the final episode of the final season, and welcome to the wonders of live radio. Thanks always to everyone for your patience while I get my bearings on how to do this live in the studio. It's still all a little new to me. For those who don't know, this is your host, Andrew Lewis. And welcome back on this Friday in the long wake of Bobby Weir's departure from this earth. And also I'd like to give a shout out and my support and words to the good citizens, both current and former of the Twin Cities. And thank you to all of you for putting your bodies on the line and doing what you can to defend all of us from illegal search and seizure. Hopefully that won't get me in any trouble for saying that. For those of you who've been following along, you know that this is a story about a walk and some statues. For those of you who are just joining, I encourage you to listen to the previous episodes, either by going to the Mountain page if you'd on KOWS, if you want to hear the live radio versions with all of their wonderful unevenness, or you can go to the podcasty versions by Googling The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts on Spotify. I also encourage you to, if you're interested, signing up for the Substack. That way I can stay in touch with listeners as need be. But for now, here's a quick recap of where we are. Basically, once upon a time, there was a city in Southern California called San Diego. And in the late 1990s, there was a group of kids in their 20s. One was an artist named John Broccoli, who got a commission to make some sculptures and prints to decorate a chapel in a local Catholic church, which is kind of a big deal because he was basically setting the stage for the revelation of the body of Christ, which isn't a burden anybody should take on. It's also one to which you have to commit. And then, of course, there was me, bearing witness to the whole thing. It's a lot, and so again, I have to thank you for your kindness. You're so good. I mean, really, you're being so good to take the time away from your lives to just be here for just this moment. So here's the thing. I don't really know anything about God. I mean, not a scholar, I'm not an academic, I don't know the Bible, and I don't really know anything at all about Jesus. So, if you're religious, or if you're just super dialed in and actually know God's intent, then I hope you can forgive me. These are just stories, bedtime stories, for which to put you to sleep. Because that's all I really do know, a bunch of stories. And beyond that, perhaps the legion of untruths that have been told to me. The Monsignor, he was a heavy man. And though in this moment I imagine him dressed in a brown friar's robe or something like that, that probably wasn't the case. I was only 3, and all I knew was that the man who lived in the pale pink house next door was a priest, and in my head, this made him a special man. And it raised, if I could even have such things, my expectations. I was a little hurt, or at least I remember it so, when I learned that he wasn't friendly. Then again, is that true? I mean, how, after half a century, do I know that? Somewhere, there's a place in my mind, just a shadow of a feeling, maybe a gruff voice, or perhaps him just ignoring me as he stood and talked over the hedge to my mother. Louis Dan Miller, who I believe also was from Minnesota, was his caregiver. But I only knew her as Lois, and I loved her because I would spend days there with her next door at the Monsignor's house. One day she took me on errands to go visit friends, elderly shut-ins who lived in Mission Hills. We stopped at a bunch of homes and canyon-side apartments at the top of rickety wooden stairs caked in these menthol eucalyptus leaves, and at every place, these old women would hand me plastic bags filled with hard candy. When we returned home, I showed my loot to my brother, hoping to make him jealous. Even though I knew it was more candy than I wanted, way, 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 way more than I could ever enjoy. Gray-haired and old and wiry, Lois was my very first friend. God came and took the Monsignor away, Lois told me. I hadn't visited for a few days. Things were different, and Lois told me why. The house felt empty and cold. I hesitantly walked up the tile stairwell and peered for the first time into the Monsignor's bedroom. It was austere, a bed stripped of sheets, a wooden cross on the wall, a sweet, smoky smell to the air. What did God look like? I asked Lois. Did you see him? I whispered.
Behavior of fleeting chance. chasing trains. The colored birds above, they're running in circles round the well, and where it spells on the wall behind St. Peter, so bright on cinder gray and spray paint. Can see forever, and please remember me seldomly in the car behind the carnival. My hand between your knees, you turn from me, said the trapeze art was wonderful, but saw me just come up with anger when it filled the circus doors, the parking lot had an element of danger, so please remember me finally. And all my uphill
listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And this is an adventure in live storytelling on KOWSLP 92.5 FM, Occidental, California. Later, something else has happened. My brother and I, we sit on the green sleeper sofa in our dad's study. It was his couch, and our mother, she asks us to put our hands together and then to repeat after her. The words, they were strung like on a necklace, clicking together like wooden beads. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. This day, our daily bread, thy will be done. We practice these words, our mother's shaking voice taking the lead. My brother and I softly followed, and I wondered about the words, not sure if they were a question, a statement of fact, or a supplication. The word funeral became something different, material. Funeral was a cheap plywood coffin clothed in steel gray fabric where my dad slept. It was hot, thick desert air that choked. It was my mother away on business, the fresh recognition that from then on everything would be different. Her mother motioned us, and I nervously followed her directions. It felt like a performance. On the other side of the grave sat a group of neighbors and friends of my dad. They sat in folding chairs and watched. And then we, my brother and I, and our mom stood on a green carpet that seemed out of place against the sand. I remember the incongruity, the thin carpet barely masking the gravelly sand beneath. We knelt, and I could feel the sand and rock against my knees. I was just a little boy, but I wore white and blue grown-up clothes, and I felt like I needed to be grown up. I felt that somehow, somewhere, he had to still be alive. It takes a long time to understand what it means for someone to be dead. A shaft of light cut through the living room window, and it illuminated these bits of dust. My mom said that this was his dust, and that he had come back to visit us. And so for some time, when I saw those dust beams, I would lay on my stomach and look as closely as I could. I would catch individual specks on my fingertips, and I would look for him. Or I stared at the swirling currents and hoped for some kind of apparition. If I compressed all that dust, could I once again make him whole and part of this world again?
There's a room inside my heart where no one ever goes. It's been boarded up and locked for years, and everything is gone. And then you come along and cut yourself a key, swept the floors and opened all the windows, said, baby, let it breathe. When I wake in the morning, will you kiss my face with a smile no one has ever seen? When I wake in the morning, will you kiss my eyes and say it's you I've loved all these years? It is you I've loved all these years. Inside your heart, baby, I believe. It's been raining there so long, and sometimes you can't hardly see. And then I'll come along and clear up everything and get it right, get it right, get it right. When you wake in the morning, I will kiss your face no one has ever seen. When you wake in the morning, I will kiss your eyes and say it's you I've loved all these years. It is you I've loved all these years. Yes, it is you I've loved all these years. It is you I've loved all these years.
This is Andrew Lewis with The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. Mrs. Hemphill, the old lady in the corner house across the street, was a widow. A widow, my mother explained, was a woman whose husband was gone. Mrs. Hemphill's husband had been an aerospace engineer. He'd designed wings for fighter jets in World War II. And they'd lived in the house even at that time when all windows had been darkened with blackout curtains to shield the light from the approaching Japanese bombers. Mr. Hemphill had been retired and he tended to roses. And then he became another person who was dead. Later, his daughter and her son Darren moved into the house and Darren and I would play together. I learned that Darren couldn't play on Sundays because he had to go to church. Darren was embarrassed by this, but when pressed, he would sometimes say it was fun. They had lunch there and had a punch social hour after the service. The Methodist Church, it was blocky with arches and parapets. It stood a block from our school. Once, while walking home, a bunch of us stopped to play on the steps, and we were sliding on the banisters until the janitor, this short, shabby man, chased us away. We were scared, but we later laughed about him because it made us feel bigger. I later learned that his name was Sidney and that he was a kind man who, because of his limp or because perhaps of some larger tragedy, had been relegated to this station as a caretaker. It began simply enough. On Sundays, I would get up early before my brother and mother, and I would walk across the street in the darkness, and I'd climb into Mrs. Hemphill's white convertible that had cracking red leather upholstery that smelled of cleaner. And we, she, Darren, and I, would drive the 1 mile to the church. This pilgrimage seemed to give comfort to Mrs. Hemphill. I was a kid gone wild, and Mrs. Hemphill, as repulsed as she was by my unkempedness, seemed to enjoy the possibility that I was being saved and that she had a part in it. It was warm at the church, and people were well-dressed, and they were awake. Sunday school was held in an adjacent building. Our teacher, Mrs. Roberts, accepted the world as God's glory as a simple fact. We would sit with Miss Roberts for an hour or so. We'd read bits from the Bible, but the words always felt as impenetrable as slate. The other kids and me would get bored. We'd goof and laugh. After Sunday school, as a surrogate for Christ's body, we would have cookies and grape punch in the church basement. Darren and I would sneak more cookies than we should. The adults, they gave me attention. When I would get home, my brother and mom would sometimes still be asleep, the house darkened by neglect, and I felt self-satisfied. Because I knew that my fate was going to be different. One day, the minister asked Darren and me to light the candles during the service. It raised our stature in Sunday school class. Each weekend, cloaked in cherry-colored robes, we slowly walked down the aisle, gingerly holding the flickering flame. And eyes would turn to us on this long walk. Farm to Pantry has been nurturing the community of Sonoma County for over 16 years. Living in such a bountiful spot on Earth, it is essential that we ensure all residents have access to the beautiful, locally grown produce available in our backyards and farms. Check out farmtopantry.org to learn more about the food justice programs, including child nutrition education, where you can get involved. Volunteer to connect with kind people and ask about their cool swag items. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and this is Andrew Lewis. A special shout out to our local residents who are supporting the folks in Minneapolis, perhaps by not making any purchases today or stepping away from work entirely or maybe a little early. I think we all need to hunker together in this moment. So onward with our adventure in storytelling. A new kid had come to Sunday school for a little while. He knew more about the Bible than any of us ever would, and he pleased Mrs. Roberts because, unlike us, he had answers to her questions. He had red cheeks and was stocky, and he conveyed this cool confidence. "Did you know," he one day asked, "that every creature has a purpose except for man?" "Our purpose," he continued, "is the worship of God." And right then, even at the age of 11, I knew that the very nature of his proposition, even in its grammar, was false. What was purpose? Who defined the parameters? Who determined what had purpose and what did not? The world was complicated and connected. How could anything at all have a purpose? A wholly human figment. And why? Why on God's earth would the most powerful entity in time and space, an entity that transcended time and space and emotion and need and want, have need for worship? His statement was as false a statement as could ever be. We sat at the low orange table, among us silence, and then Miss Roberts nodded her head in agreement. "What you say is true," she said. 1 year for Christmas, Miss Roberts gave me a present wrapped in red holiday paper. It was a paperback book. On the cover, there was an inked picture of a man with a chiseled jaw and about him figures of gang members. You could tell that because their skin was slightly complected. It was called The Cross and the Switchblade. And it was about a man, David Wilkerson, a Pentecostal preacher who came to New York City from Appalachia in the 1950s to minister to street gangs. Miss Roberts perhaps thought that this book would speak to me, that I would know what it felt like to be abandoned and then to find solace in the Word of God, to know perhaps that there was someone in the world who was ready now to minister unto me. In the book, Pastor Wilkerson was seeking a home for the street children to whom he tended. But he had no money. He had no place to go. He explained how he placed a fleece before the Lord, as had Gideon before his battle with the Midianites, when he challenged God to show his existence. Gideon had placed a fleece upon the ground and had asked God to wet the ground, yet spare the fleece, and to keep it dry. "If you exist, God, and if my mission is true," Pastor Wilkerson prayed, "then guide me to a solution." Pastor Wilkerson then drove through the night, steered only by the hand of God, apparently, and he traversed the streets of Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn until he felt nowhere else to go, and he cut the engine to his car. And there he was to find that right before him was a building that would be given to him to house the children abandoned to the street. Could this be true? I wondered. Could such miracles transpire on our modern earth? Ambulances came to our house again and again. They were not new, only part of the constant crumbling. One time, Mrs. Tom, Darren's mother, and our neighbor, Mrs. Ford, asked me to wait outside, though other times I'd been on the inside. Even now, I can see the scene clearly. My mom unconscious on the floor, the paramedics in blue jackets kneeling around her, the sharp gestures, the tearing of plastic, paramedics talking quickly, numbers and letters. Sometimes I imagined that she would die, and I wondered what would become of my brother and me. This time, though, I sat outside beneath the pepper trees, and I hung on to the knotted swinging rope that we had tied to the branches, and I knelt in the dirt patch in the center of the lawn. I shut my eyes and craned my head back, as one might do if one were seeking to be holy, and I placed my face skyward and I prayed. I placed my own fleece before the Lord. I asked God to make her well. I told God that I would do anything for her to get better. I squeezed my eyes as tight as I could, hoping to make him listen. I prayed hard. But I heard yet another voice inside me. This voice knew that she would get better regardless. This voice knew that the ambulance would take her to Mercy Hospital, and that in a few days she would be back. She would be fine, and God would have had nothing to do with it. The gurney holding my mother's strapped body rattled down the steps. I cried, relieved that she would be okay, and I thanked God for caring for her. Kneeling there on the dead lawn, I knew suddenly, with as much certainty as I ever would, that this being to whom I had prayed did not now, nor would ever, in this vast expanse of time, ever exist. Stacy in Sunday school class had been confirmed. A ceremony was held in the church where she took communion and ended up with a red Bible, the cover imprinted with her name in gold. So badly did I want a Bible with my name on it. And Miss Roberts set about preparing me for my confirmation. But as the date grew close, I felt unsure. A deadline approached, and I delayed and delayed again, and Miss Roberts became irritated because she couldn't understand why I would not want such a thing. At last, my mother and I were asked to sit with the minister, Mr. Wright, so that I could explain my reasoning. But to him, I had no answer. I didn't have the words to explain. But Mr. Wright understood something. He sat for a bit and then spoke. "What if we give you the Bible now?" he offered. "And when you're ready, you can get confirmed." I sat ashamed. And yet, I could not contain my avarice. And so I agreed. Mr. Wright handed me the book I so coveted. And only when we had reached our car and I sat inside did I dare to examine the volume, and I discovered that my name had been printed crooked. Sometime later, the book was left in the heat, and an old magazine stuck to the cover, and never would I ever be able to get that book clean.
I stole my colors onto the floor like a newborn babe into the earth. I thought it was righteous, but no, it's not. No, it's not. I watched your fingers dancing on my guitar. I watched the empires rise and fall. I watched his daggers rain down from the clouds. I watched your fingers dancing on my guitar. I spilled my colors onto the floor.
been listening to episode 8 of The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. This has been The Confirmation. This is the final episode of part 1 of The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. If you're worried, don't be. There are many, many, many other episodes queued up. So you have lots of storytelling listening ahead of you. Today's music includes The Cold, Cold Ground by the inimitable Tom Waits, who actually hails from San Diego, Chula Vista specifically, I think, as well as he's a hometown hero in West County. Tom, if you're listening, let it be known that my wife studied English with Francis Thumb. So if you see Francis, give him a shout out from us. That was followed by The Trapeze Swinger by Iron and Wine. Let It Breathe by Water Liars. Pink and Blue by Phoebe Hunt. And No It's Not by Workman Song. We'll be stepping out to the sound of Some Mountaintop by The Weather Machine. And as always, although I oftentimes forget to mention it, special thanks to the Blue Dot Sessions for the background loop, The Telling, from their 2017 album, Marisala. I also want to give a shout out to all of you out there who are holding fast and doing everything you can to preserve this wonderful experiment in democracy that we have and tender so dear. And hold fast, hold faith, continue to do your good work and to support all those around you, especially those who are in need or are perhaps under threat. If you want to stay abreast of the mountain and what's going on, I encourage you to sign up to the Mountain Substack. Just Google The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, and it should be the first thing that pops up. If you subscribe, I will be able to let you know of what's going on and as this spreads across radio land. Please know that I've really enjoyed telling these stories. And I appreciate having you all listening out there with at least half an ear. So, by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bit bigger, please consider sharing with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
Just great, been waiting for hours that turned into days. Made me ancient, you recovered, and now the light's in your eyes. So I'll meet you for dinner on some mountaintop. Just don't let me stop. I've picked a direction and you've seen two too. Cause blues is the sky and your heart's color too. Meet you for dinner on some mountaintop. And the city's a picture of forgotten scripture with prayers in their place. I might need a god, but I don't need her face. I don't need her face anymore. So come find my door. We'll make us a present of laughter and cream. A room made for two with a place set for three. And I'll meet you for dinner on some mountaintop. Ooh.
time I saw my newborn girl, she was pulling on her mama's hair. The sun coming through